Well, hello, folks, and welcome to the Lamar Countyan Podcast. This is Will Gilmer back behind the microphone for the first time in what seems like ages. You know, when my family got out of the dairy farming business last February, I thought, well, you know, I'll have a little more time now to devote to writing and doing some podcasts. And as it turns out, that's not happened. It's not that I haven't had the time. It's just that I've found that a better use of my time is spent actually being more involved with my family, spending time with my wife and kids, and also catching up on some of the sleep I've lost over the last 20, 25 years. So I've had the time. I've just found better uses of it than sitting behind a keyboard or a microphone. And, you know, that's probably just as well. Anyway, though, I did publish a new Lamar Countyan newsletter this week, went out on Friday, and thought I'd hop on here and maybe fill in the blanks, talk about a few of the things that I just didn't have space to include in it. Now, the whole thing was essentially about the election we had this past Tuesday, and I'll just start off, and I'll kind of just run through this podcast in the same order as I did the newsletter. If you haven't read it yet, I'd encourage you to go do so. Of course, you can subscribe to it, lamarcountyan.substack.com. And if you subscribe, every time I publish something new, it'll all automatically be sent to your inbox. But in reviewing the election this past Tuesday, you know, there were three questions that I had in my mind going into it that were answered. And then there's two new questions that we can ask moving forward based off what the results were on Tuesday. So just to begin, my overall, according to the numbers, the unofficial numbers on the Secretary of State's website, we had just over 3,400 people in this county go vote. I think the actual number was 3,408. And that works out to just a fuzz over 31% of our county's registered voters. Now I'll tell you, that's disappointing. You know not to expect super high numbers, but anything below 40% on any election to me is a disappointment. Now, if it's a runoff for a non-local race, yeah, maybe I can, you know, give it a pass, but I think we ought to be at least hitting on 40% every time a primary or a general election rolls around. Now, I fully expect in November at the general election, you know, which will obviously be highlighted by the presidential election, I think we will have a big turnout. I think we'll be bumping up hopefully somewhere around 50% on that, but we need to do better. We need to do better on our voting. But I will say we took our responsibility to vote more seriously here in Lamar County than the statewide average, which was only 21%. So, you know, good job, I guess, Lamar County. Anyway, going in, there were some things going into Election Day that you really didn't have to wonder about. One of those was, you know, will most people vote the Republican Party ballot? And the answer to that was obviously yes. Lamar County is one of the reddest counties in one of the reddest states in this country. And the fact that, you know, we don't have anybody running as a Democrat on the local for a local elections anymore, and very few for state positions, will just tell you, just if you want to have a say in much of anything, you almost have to vote Republican ticket, even if your politics don't line up with the Republican Party. But it is what it is. Over 90%, I think it was actually closer to 94%. I don't remember off the top of my head. But somewhere around 94% of the people in Lamar County that voted Republican. And almost, you know, predictably, almost every one of those who did also supported Donald Trump for president in the presidential primary. I'll be honest, Nikki Haley and uncommitted got marked more than I was expecting. But still, again, Donald Trump, the overwhelming choice for Lamar Countyans to be the Republican nominee. And, you know, at this point, Nikki Haley was still in the race Tuesday. She since suspended her campaign. I mean, it's a foregone conclusion anybody could see that's the direction that this was going, that Donald Trump was going to easily wrap up the Republican nomination. So moving on, I said, let's talk about some of the questions I actually had. One of those was the question, is Congressman Robert Atter Holt untouchable? Now, I went back and did some research, and you know, congressional incumbents are notoriously hard to defeat, especially after they've had two or three terms under their belt. Well, Atter Holt serving currently his 14th. So at the end of this year, he will have served 28 years in the House of Representatives. And he's not had a close election in the general or primary in years. I think going back and looking at since 2002, he's never failed to gain at least 70% of the vote. Now this year, his challenger, Justin Holcomb, he was a guy I had never heard of until he showed up to speak at a county Republican meeting back end of last year. And I'll be honest, I wasn't impressed with him. I've heard him speak in Lamar County twice. Neither time I was impressed with him at all. I mean, to the point, like, there was nothing he said in reasons why anybody should support him that I thought were good reasons. To put it another way, if this had been an open race with no incumbent running, I seriously doubt he would have been the candidate that I would be supporting. That said, put aside the reasons he tried to propose to vote for him, the reasons he gave for not reelecting Atter Holt were actually some arguments I've been hearing more and more over, at least on this the western side of District 4. You know, and that's that he's been there long enough. He's been there a long time, and what do we really have to show for it? And you know, a lot of that I disagree with because you know I've been in a position where I've had an opportunity to work, you know, with people in his office. Anytime I've had a need or a request, I've had access. So, you know, my relationship and my ability to work with Congressman Atter Holt in his office is different than what most people is, and I recognize that. But still, just out there amongst the public, I've been hearing more and more grumbling about it, and so I thought, well, maybe there's a building case of, you know, what I call Atter Holt fatigue out there. And even if Holcomb is not a good candidate, he might have some of that playing over in his favor. And I thought, just based off what I heard around here, you know, this guy might pull in 25, 30, maybe even 35% of the vote. Well, turns out I was way off. Across District 4, Atter Holt, I mean, he easily secured re-election with 80% of the vote. And here in Lamar County, it was up to 85. So right here where I'm hearing more grumbling than I ever have before, he got about as much support as he ever has. So that just leads me to believe that, you know, it's going to be his job as long as he wants it. Really, the only way I could see the only kind of person I could see that could even pose a legitimate challenge would be somebody who's, you know, already been serving in some sort of office, like maybe like a state senate position for a couple of terms, two or three terms. Somebody that's already got some name ID out there. Somebody who's already established themselves as a good, solid conservative. And even then, I mean, it'd be an uphill battle. It would almost have to be like you'd have to have a real strong challenger 1 year to show that he's actually vulnerable, and then another good strong candidate maybe the next time to capitalize that and pick him off. But you know, still, I don't think it's going to happen. I think Congressman Atter Holt will be holding that position as long as he wants to run for it. So moving on, the second question that I had was, could our current probate judge, Sharon Nethery, hold on and secure a second term? And that's been something that's been tough for, at least in my lifetime, for probate judges here in this county to do, you know, with the notable exception of Johnny Rogers, who was able to secure three terms, I believe. But for whatever reason, that position just doesn't have a whole lot of job security. Now, when she entered that office back in 2019. She was elected in 2018 and went into office at the very beginning of 2019. She entered, you know, her background working in a legal office probably gave her more relevant work experience than anybody that's held that position in a long, long time. And so she went in well equipped to do the job, but for whatever reason, public relations, well, I don't know what, but she's never really been able to grow that initial base of support she has. And in politics, it's not just about can you do the job, it's can you do the job the way it needs to be done and grow your base of support while doing it. And, you know, obviously she was not able to do that. She's been what I'd consider plagued throughout her tenure as being seen as somewhat of a weak candidate, just by virtue of as far back as, you know, 2020, 2021, people were already starting to float names about who might potentially challenge her. You know, usually that doesn't happen until the last 2 years of somebody's term, but it was happening right towards the middle of hers. And ultimately, I guess the numbers played it out. David Boyette won that election, by 60%, you know, a 60-40 split. And, you know, talking to people leading up to the election, I mean, I never came across anybody that was felt real strongly one way or the other. I wasn't really sure how that race was going to play out. Now, as I put in my newsletter, a few days before the election, I saw that she had posted a quote about leadership and how, you know, if you're willing to serve in leadership, get ready to be rejected, second guessed, misunderstood, all this, you know, it kind of comes with the territory. You know, hey, every bit of that is true. But when I saw that, I was like, well, that's something that's mighty strange for somebody who's running for election to post without any kind of context, you know, 3 or 4 days before an election. I mean, to me, my initial impression was, well, is this like admitting defeat, or is it trying to drum up some sympathy vote or something? Because it was just an odd choice to post something about leaders being rejected right before you're asking the people to support you. Now, obviously that's not what she intended to do. And she has, she has publicly let me know that was not her intention. I mean, she dropped a comment that started off with "all due respect," which anybody knows an "all due respect" line means with no respect whatsoever. And told me I shouldn't read so much into things. And hey, that's probably right. You know, all of us tend to read stuff into things that we shouldn't. But I've been doing this social media thing long enough to know that you know, the person who hits the send button is ultimately the one responsible for being clear about what they mean. When you post something on social media, if you're not really clear about what the context is, expect it to be interpreted in any number of ways, misinterpreted, misunderstood, whatever. That's just how it is. I mean, that's the nature of the beast in social media. But anyway, I do think that from everything I've seen, she's done a good job as our probate judge. I thought we had a candidate for him back in February, about a month before the election. And I thought she did a tremendous job explaining what the job actually involves, why she was qualified and the most qualified to do it. I thought she knocked her speech out of the park. But ultimately, I just go back to that whole PR thing. It's in politics, it's not just how good you do the job. It's can you win support along the way for doing it? And in the end, she wasn't able to. She did a good job for 5 years that she served. I have every confidence that she'll finish out her term through this year with integrity and will be successful in whatever she does moving forward. So moving forward, the third question I had, and I don't really want to touch this. This is, to my opinion, this is kind of a horse that's been about beat to death, but would voters in District 2 put an end to the drama over Kevin King's residency. So if you're not aware, there's been questions about does Kevin King actually live in his district or not. He owns property in Mississippi. Some people claim that that's where he lives. He has said and told me directly that he still lives in his district, lives with his lives with his father. And there was a ballot challenge filed after qualification on the last day a challenge could be filed. In fact, questioning that, and ultimately the decision was made by the County Republican Party to leave him on the ballot. Now, there's been a lot of second guessing about that. I understand that some people were upset by that decision, but ultimately everybody I talked to in District 2 about it, both before and after that decision was made, they either didn't see this as an issue whatsoever, or they wanted to be the ones to make the decision by how they voted. And, you know, if there had been several candidates running for that position, that might have changed things a little bit. But with just a two-man race, let's err on the side of giving the voters a choice. And ultimately, they did. I mean, they voted overwhelmingly for Mitchell Puckett, who Kevin King defeated, I guess, 8 years ago when he first became a commissioner. And so, you know, with Mitchell Puckett winning 70% of the vote, you know, first of all, let's give credit to him. I mean, that's a lot of that has to do with him. You don't take anything away from somebody that can get 70% of the vote. But also, though, I mean, you do look at it, if a two-term incumbent can only get 30% of the vote in a two-man race, I mean, that tells you there's something going on. He didn't suddenly lose that much support in one term because he couldn't do the job. So whatever all the reasons were behind it, whatever voters made the choice they voted, it's kind of put an end to all this. And I'm worried and I'm afraid that had King won, this question would have persisted. There could have been some lawsuits filed. I don't know what all would have happened, but as it is, the result stands, and it's just really not anything we have to worry about anymore. So those are three questions in my mind that were answered by the election. There's a couple of questions now that the results create. And the first one of those, to me, is could we be seeing a change in county governance on the horizon? Now, in the lead up to the election, I mentioned earlier a candidate forum that we had about a month prior to it. And one of the questions that we asked both probate judge candidates was their thoughts on switching our county from a district system to a unit system. And based off their responses, and along with private individual conversations that I had had with them previously, it seemed to me that David Boyette was far more open to the idea of at least exploring whether a change in governance was would be something worthwhile to do. Now, again, I've already misinterpreted one thing from Judge Nethery on social media, and I may have misinterpreted her comments that night, but I just did feel that Boyette was far more likely to take a look at this. Now, if you don't understand what I'm talking about, the way our county is currently set up, you know, we have four districts. Each district has its own money, its own road crew, its own equipment, and the commissioner in that district, you know, all our commissioners are full time. So, I mean, their job is to directly manage what's happening in their district. So that, in effect, makes them foreman of their crews, and so that's where they spend the bulk of their time, but they also have to come together and make decisions related to county business. If you switch to a unit system, as most counties in Alabama have done, the general idea, because there's a lot of different ways that you could manage this, but the general idea is all of the money and equipment and crews that the districts have would be consolidated and centralized, probably under the county engineer's office, or create a position for county supervisor, which would operate under the purview of the county commission. But it would all be centralized and dispatched out from there. They'd have a plan of how they would manage, you know, countywide, all the infrastructure. And at least in the idea I would have of what would be smart for our county if we went that direction, our commissioners would have their, you know, would be reduced back down to part-time, where obviously they'd be keeping an eye on what's happening in their district. They'd be able to answer calls from constituents and try to direct the engineer's office, whoever was in charge of to handle needs within their district. But their primary focus at this point would not be managing the day-to-day operations of infrastructure maintenance, but actually come together and predominantly be concerned with managing the county's business. Now, there's a lot of different ways that you can structure this. Some of these would work, I think, in my opinion, really good for our county. There's also ways you could structure it that could be an absolute disaster. But getting back to the thing, you know, the original question, a probate judge does not have the authority to mandate or dictate any change like this. But they are in position to initiate the conversation about it and kind of guide the process and kind of stewarded and shepherded along to get there. So in my mind, what I'd like to see David Boyette do once he assumes office is put together some kind of study committee, or you know, maybe it's all done within the commission, I don't know, but assemble a group of people together who take a look at what's working in other counties, what's not working, try to formulate a plan of what a change in system would look like here in Lamar County and how it could be the most efficient. Schedule a series of public meetings, public hearings to get local people's input on it. And, you know, that's just all the first step. And that in and of itself would take time. The actual process to implement something like this would, you got to develop a plan, and that plan's going to have to be approved by the county commission, whoever is in the county commission at that time, and realize such a plan would probably affect their, you know, affect the description of their job. So you know, you got that part as well. But you know, it would have to be approved by the county commission and likely unanimously for it to be then taken to Montgomery, passed through the legislature as a local bill and signed by the governor, which if it gets to Montgomery, if it got unanimous approval by our commissioners, it should pretty much be a rubber stamp in Montgomery. But then it would come back to the county, be put on the ballot for our county to vote on it, to vote whether or not to approve it. If our county did approve a change in governance style, baked into that plan would be some kind of transition period. You can't just snap your fingers and overnight it would come into place. Part of that would have to do with the terms of the current commissioners, particularly if you were going to be rolling them back to to part time. You'd have to wait until the next election, the next two election cycles to work that out, because you can't change the term of office of somebody who's currently sitting in office. So, I mean, you're looking at, even once a plan is formulated, it's got to get approved, which will take some time. Then it's got to be implemented, which will take even more time. So this would be a very long process. It wouldn't happen overnight. But if it's ever going to happen, a first step has to be taken. And I'm more optimistic that step's going to be taken now than I was at any point in the past. All right, the last question that we have have to ask now is, who's Governor Ivey going to appoint to be our next revenue commissioner? So because Boyette will still have 2 years remaining on his term once he moves over into the probate office, that's going to leave it to the governor to appoint somebody to fill out the remainder of that term. I have no idea how this will play out. The governor could appoint somebody who's already working in that office and she may elevate them to that position. Whether she does that or she brings in somebody from the outside, she may put a stipulation on it that she will only appoint somebody who agrees to only fill that position for the remainder of the term. In other words, serve as an interim or a caretaker, but somebody who's willing not to actually run for that position next time it's on the ballot. Or she could put somebody in there that has an interest in that job long term and give them a couple of years of experience that they can use to give them a leg up if they want to run next time it's voted on, which I believe will be 2026. I'll say, I don't know. I've not heard any names being floated for that. I don't know how the governor is going to decide on that. If it's something that you might be interested in, or somebody, or if there's somebody that you know that would be a good candidate for it, contact the governor's office. Go ahead and get them some names and give her something to consider. This isn't something that is going to have to be figured out in the next couple of months. I basically got through the end of the year to decide this, but we, you know, we do need, you know, from the half of the county, we do need somebody in that position that's that either knows what they're doing or is going to be a quick learner, so we don't have a disruption of service there. All right, and let me just close. I'll kind of close the same way as I did with as I did on the newsletter. I just touched on the State of the Union address that we heard Tuesday night, and I thought President Biden did what he needed to do for himself, which was to shore up his support within his own party. You know, there's been a lot of rumors that when the Democrats have their convention this summer, there may be efforts to undercut him and put somebody else in his place, even if he's, you know, clearly was going to be the victor in the primary elections leading up to that. But I think he did enough to show, hey, he can still make it, or at least in the eyes of his own party. He made it very difficult for them to find a replacement. Let me just put it that way. Of course, I disagreed with almost everything that he said. It was more of a campaign speech than it was a legitimate State of the Union address, but that's par for the course these days. I don't care which party is in the White House. The State of the Union address in and of itself, except in times of national emergency, and which, well, you could argue that we kind of are right now on a lot of fronts, but it's really just been, it's become a dog and pony show, all political. It doesn't have anything to do with taking the temperature and giving an honest assessment of where our country is in any moment of time. I'd be happy if it went back to the old days where the president just submitted a written report to Congress to be read into the record, rather than have this whole televised mess. But I tune in. Millions of others do too. And until we just turn the TVs off, they're going to continue doing it like they continue doing it. Now, shortly after the State of the Union address was over, as is customary, the party that's not in power in the White House always gives a response. The Republican Party chose our very own Senator Katie Britt to give a response. And I thought that the message that she gave was spot on. She hit a lot of good notes on it. Now, if you've looked online, if you've watched shows, the reviews of how she gave that speech have been very mixed. And I'll tell you, I thought she didn't do a great job personally. I've seen her give enough speeches that I know sometimes she has a tendency to dial it up, dial the dramatics up a little bit too much. I think she did that in this case. Didn't come off as genuine as she sometimes does, but you know, I'm a big Brit supporter. I was on her bandwagon right from the get-go, even before she officially joined the race to run for Senate. I still am. I think she's incredibly talented, and I'm not going to argue that she's one of the greatest orators of our generation, but she doesn't need to be. Her skill set has her positioned perfectly to serve our state and to serve our nation in the U.S. Senate and grow in leadership positions. And honestly, I think that's a perfect place for her. Different pundits have been talking about her response Thursday night being a potential audition to be Trump's running mate. And I'll be honest, I think we'd be wasting her talent in a vice presidential position, or at least at this point. Maybe someday there'd be a good path for her to be in the executive branch. But right now, she's needed in the Senate. We need her in the Senate. She can do some tremendous things for us in the Senate, and I at least hope that she'll stay there for for at least two more terms and do some great work there. Well, folks, that's about enough for now. I appreciate y'all taking the time to listen. I appreciate you taking the time to read and subscribe to the Lamar County newsletter. I'm going to try to do better. I'm going to try to start getting some stuff out more regularly. Elections are low-hanging fruit to talk about. It gets a little bit tougher, just in the middle of April, May, June, July, to find things worthy to talk about, particularly at a county level. So I may just have to broaden my horizons a little bit. But again, I do thank you for listening. I appreciate your support. And until next time, God bless you all.